the desired office, packing. He shook his head and his voice cracked a bit when he said, "Given that I've had the best numbers for the past 6 quarters, you'd think I'd like that system. But I don't. I absolutely hate it. It's a miserable environment." He then told me how after the previous quarterly results were in, his boss walked into his office, closed the door, and told him that he had to move offices. Don said, "At first I thought my numbers had dropped. Then he told me that he didn't care if I had the best numbers or if I even liked my office. The point was to terrorize the other guys." He said, "Busting their balls in public builds character. It's motivating." Before the end of our interview, Don told me he was job hunting. He said, "I'm good at my job, and I even enjoy it, but I didn't sign up to terrorize people. I never knew why it felt so shitty, but after hearing you talk, now I do. It's shame. It's worse than high school. I'll find a better place to work, and you can be damn sure that I'm taking my clients with me." In my earlier book, I thought it was just me. I tell the following story about Sylvia, an event planner in her 30s who jumped right into our interview by saying, "I wish you could have interviewed me 6 months ago. I was a different person. I was so stuck in shame." When I asked her what she meant, she explained that she had heard about my research from a friend and volunteered to be interviewed because she felt like her life had been changed by shame. She had recently had an important breakthrough when she found herself on the losers list at work. Apparently, after 2 years of what her employer called outstanding winner's work, she had made her first big mistake. The mistake cost her agency a major client. Her boss's response was to put her on the loser's list. She said, "In 1 minute, I went from being on the winner's board to being at the top of the loser's list." I guess I must have winced when Sylvia referred to the loser's list, because without my remarking at all, she said, "I know, it's terrible. My boss has these two big dry erase boards outside of his office. One's the winner's list and one board is for the losers." She said for weeks she could barely function. She lost her confidence and started missing work. Shame, anxiety, and fear took over. After a difficult 3-week period, she quit her job and went to work for another agency. Shame can only rise so far in any system before people disengage to protect themselves. When we're disengaged, we don't show up, we don't contribute, and we stop caring. On the far end of the spectrum, disengagement allows people to rationalize all kinds of unethical behavior, including lying, stealing, and cheating. In the case of Don and Sylvia, they didn't just disengage, they quit, and they took their talent to competitors. As we assess our organizations for signs of shame, it's also important to be aware of external threats, forces outside of our organizations that are influencing how both leaders and employees feel about their work. As a teacher and the sister of 2 former public school teachers and the sister-in-law of a former public high school vice principal, I don't have to look far for examples of this. Several years ago, my sister Ashley called me crying. When I asked her what was wrong, she told me that the Houston Chronicle had published the name of every school teacher in the Houston Independent School District, along with the bonus they received based on their students' standardized test scores. I hadn't seen the paper that day, and I was stunned. And I was also confused. "Ash, you teach kindergarten. Your kids don't take tests yet. Is your name in there?" Ashley explained that her name was in there, and that the paper reported that she got the lowest bonus available. What they didn't report was that it was the highest bonus available to kindergarten teachers. Imagine doing that. Reporting everyone's salaries or bonuses, and moreover, reporting them inaccurately to any other group of professionals. "I'm in a total shame meltdown," Ashley said, still crying. "All I've ever wanted to do was be a teacher. I work my butt off. I've hit up everyone in our family for money so I can buy school supplies for the kids who can't afford them. I stay after and help the parents help their kids. I don't get it. There are hundreds of teachers like me. And do you read about that in the paper? No. And it's not just about me. Some of the very best teachers I know volunteer to teach some of the most challenging students without any thought about how it's going to affect their scores or bonuses. They do it because they love their work and they believe in the kids." Unfortunately, the scarlet letter approach to teacher evaluation is not just happening in Texas. It's becoming an accepted practice across the nation. The good news is that people are finally daring greatly and speaking up. in response to the New York State Court of Appeals ruling that teachers' individual performance assessments could be made public. Bill Gates wrote this in a New York Times op-ed. Developing a systematic way to help teachers get better is the most powerful idea in education today. The surest way to weaken it is to twist it into a capricious exercise in public shaming. Let's focus on creating a personnel system that truly helps teachers improve. When I posted Gates' op-ed on my Facebook page, many teachers left comments. I was moved by this response from a veteran teacher. For me, teaching is about love. It's not about transferring information, but rather creating an atmosphere of mystery and imagination and discovery. When I begin to lose myself because of some unresolved pain or fears or the overpowering feelings of shame, then I no longer teach. I deliver information, and I think I become irrelevant then. Teachers are not the only ones who are publicly shamed. I'm often asked to address this issue when I'm speaking with professionals who are routinely vilified, disliked, or mistrusted by the public. Lawyers, dentists, and folks from the financial industry are a few. We might roll our eyes and think, come on, we love to hate them. But I can tell you from my experiences that it's not fun to feel hated simply for doing the work that means something to you. And it can take a serious toll on individuals and cultures. As leaders, the most effective thing we can do when this kind of media abuse is happening is speak out, insist on accuracy and accountability, and confront it head on with the people affected by it. We can't pretend that it's not hurting our employees. On a personal level, we can resist buying into and perpetuating the public stereotyping of professions that by their nature operate in the realms of personal stress. The blame game. Here's the best way to think about the relationship between shame and blame. If blame is driving, shame is riding shotgun. In organizations, schools, and families, blaming and finger-pointing are often symptoms of shame. Shame researchers June Tangney and Rhonda Deering explained that in shame-bound relationships, people measure carefully, weigh, and assign blame. They write, "In the face of any negative outcome, large or small, someone or something must be found responsible and held accountable. There's no notion of water under the bridge." They go on to say, "After all, if someone must be to blame, and it's not me, it must be you." From blame comes shame, and then hurt, denial, anger, and retaliation. Blame is simply the discharging of pain and discomfort. We blame when we're uncomfortable and experience pain, when we're vulnerable, angry, hurt, in shame, grieving. There's nothing productive about blame, and it often involves shaming someone or just being mean. If blame is a pattern in your culture, then shame needs to be addressed as an issue. Cover-up culture. Related to blame is the issue of cover-ups. Just like blame is a sign of shame-based organizations, cover-up cultures depend on shame to keep folks quiet. When the culture of an organization mandates that it's more important to protect the reputation of a system and those in power than it is to protect the basic human dignity of individuals or communities, you can be certain that shame is systemic, money drives ethics, and accountability is dead. This is true in all systems, from corporations, nonprofits, universities, and governments, to churches, schools, families, and sports programs. If you think back on any major incidents fueled by cover-ups, you'll see this pattern. In an organizational culture where respect and the dignity of individuals are held as the highest values, shame and blame don't work as management styles. There is no leading by fear. Empathy is a valued asset. Accountability is an expectation rather than an exception. And the primal human need for belonging is not used as leverage and social control. We can't control the behavior of individuals. However, we can cultivate organizational cultures where behaviors are not tolerated and people are held accountable for protecting what matters most, human beings. We won't solve the complex issues that we're facing today without creativity, innovation, and engaged learning. We can't afford to let our discomfort with the topic of shame get in the way of recognizing and combating it in our schools and workplaces. The four best strategies for building shame-resilient organizations are as follows. 1. supporting leaders who are willing to dare greatly and facilitate honest conversations about shame and cultivate shame-resilient cultures. Number two, facilitating a conscientious effort to see where shame might be functioning in the organization and how it might even be creeping into the way we engage with our coworkers or students. Three, normalizing is a critical shame-resilient strategy. Leaders and managers can cultivate engagement by helping people know what to expect. What are the common struggles? How have other people dealt with them? What have your experiences been? And last, training all employees on the differences between shame and guilt and teaching them how to give and receive feedback in a way that fosters growth and engagement. Minding the gap with feedback. A daring greatly culture is a culture of honest, constructive, and engaged feedback. This is true in organizations, schools, and families. I know families struggle with this issue. However, I was shocked to see lack of feedback emerge as a primary concern in the interviews that focused on work experiences. Today's organizations are so metric-focused in their evaluation of performance that giving, receiving, and soliciting valuable feedback, ironically, has become rare. It's even a rarity in schools where learning depends on feedback, which is infinitely more effective than grades scribbled on the top of a page or computer-generated standardized test scores. The problem is straightforward. Without feedback, there can be no transformative change. When we don't talk to the people we're leading about their strengths and their opportunities for growth, they begin to question their contributions and our commitment. Disengagement follows. When I asked people why there's such a lack of feedback in their organizations and schools, they used different language, but the two major issues were the same. One, we're not comfortable with hard conversations. Two, we don't know how to give and receive feedback in a way that moves people and processes forward. The good news is that these are very fixable problems. If an organization makes the creation of a feedback culture a priority and a practice, rather than an aspirational value, it can happen. People are desperate for feedback. We all want to grow. We just need to learn how to give feedback in a way that inspires growth and engagement. Right off the bat, I believe that feedback thrives in cultures where the goal is not getting comfortable with hard conversations, but normalizing discomfort. If leaders expect real learning, critical thinking, and change, then discomfort should be normalized. For example, we believe growth and learning are uncomfortable. So it's going to happen here. You're going to feel that way. We want you to know that it's normal and it's an expectation here. You're not alone, and we ask that you stay open and lean into it. This is true at all levels and in all organizations, schools, faith communities, and even families. I've observed this pattern of normalized discomfort in the wholehearted organizations I've researched, and I've lived it in my classroom and with my family. I learned to teach by immersing myself in books on engaged and critical pedagogy by writers like bell hooks and Paulo Freire. At first, I was terrified by the idea that if education is going to be transformative, it's going to be uncomfortable and unpredictable. Now, as I begin my 21st year of teaching at the University of Houston, I always tell my students, if you're comfortable, I'm not teaching and you're not learning. It's going to get uncomfortable in here, and that's okay. It's normal and it's part of the process. The simple and honest process of letting people know that discomfort is normal, it's going to happen, why it happens, and why it's important, reduces anxiety, fear, and shame. Periods of discomfort become an expectation and a norm. In fact, most semesters I have students who approach me after class and say, I haven't been uncomfortable yet. I'm concerned. These exchanges often lead to critically important conversations and feedback about their engagement in my teaching. The big challenge for leaders is getting our heads and hearts around the fact that we need to cultivate the courage to be uncomfortable and to teach the people around us how to accept discomfort as part of growth. For the best guidance on how to give feedback that moves people and processes forward, I turn to my social work roots. In my experience, the heart of valuable feedback is taking the strengths perspective. And according to social work educator Dennis Saleeby, viewing performance from the strengths perspective offers us the opportunity to examine our struggles in the light of our capacities, talents, competencies, possibilities, visions, values, and hopes. This perspective doesn't dismiss the serious nature of our struggles. However, it does require us to consider our positive qualities as potential resources. Dr. Saleeby proposes, It is as wrong to deny the possible as it is to deny the problem. One effective method for understanding our strengths is to examine the relationship between strengths and limitations. If we look at what we do best as well as what we want to change the most, we will often find that the two are varying degrees of the same core behavior. Most of us can go through the majority of our faults or limitations and find strengths lurking within. For example, I can beat myself up for being too controlling, micromanaging, or I can recognize that I'm very responsible, dependable, and committed to quality work. The micromanaging issues don't go away. But by viewing them from a strengths perspective, I have the confidence to look at myself and assess the behaviors I'd like to change. I want to emphasize that the strengths perspective is not a tool to simply allow us to put a positive spin on a problem and consider it solved. But by first enabling us to inventory our strengths, it suggests ways that we can use those strengths to address the related challenges. One way I teach this perspective to students is by requiring them to give and receive feedback on their classroom presentations. When students present, they receive feedback from every one of their classmates. The students in the audience have to identify three observable strengths and one opportunity for growth. The trick is that they have to use their assessment of the strengths to make a suggestion on how the individual might address the specified opportunity. For example, strengths might include, you captured my interest right away with your emotional personal story. You used examples that are relevant to my life. You concluded with actionable strategies that tie in with our learning in the class. The opportunity. Your stories and examples made me feel connected to you and what you are saying, but I sometimes struggled to read the PowerPoint and listen to you at the same time. I didn't want to miss anything you were saying, but I worried about not following the slides. You might experiment with fewer words on the slides, or maybe even no slides. You had me without them. The research has made this clear. Vulnerability is at the heart of the feedback process. This is true whether we give, receive, or solicit feedback. And the vulnerability doesn't go away, even if we're trained and experienced in offering and getting feedback. Experience does, however, give us the advantage of knowing that we can survive the exposure and uncertainty, and that it's worth the risk. One of the greatest mistakes that I see people make in the feedback process is armoring up. To protect ourselves from the vulnerability of giving or receiving feedback, we get ready for a fight. Cue the jock jams. Cue the stadium anthems. It's easy to assume that the feedback process only feels vulnerable for the person receiving the feedback, but that's not true. Honest engagement around expectations and behaviors is always fraught with uncertainty, risk, and emotional exposure for everyone involved. Here's an example. Susan, the principal of a large high school, has to talk to one of her teachers about several parent complaints. The parents have voiced concerns about the teacher's cursing during class and making personal calls on her cell phone while she allows her students to leave the class, goof off, and make their own calls. In this situation, armoring up can take several forms. One is that Susan can fill out the probation form and have it sitting on her desk when the teacher comes in. She'll simply say, "Here's the complaint. I've written you up for the following offenses. Sign here and do not let it happen again." She's knocked out the meeting in 3 minutes flat. There's no feedback, no growth, no learning, but it's over. The odds of the teacher changing her behaviors are slim. Another way we armor up is by convincing ourselves that the other person deserves to be hurt or put down. Like most of us, Susan is more comfortable with anger than vulnerability. So she ratchets up her confidence with a little self-righteousness. "I'm so sick of this. If these teachers respected me, they'd never do stuff like this. I have had it. She's been a problem since the first day I met her." You want to jack around in class? Go for it. I'm fixing to show you exactly how this works. The opportunity for constructive feedback and relationship building turns into a smackdown. Again, it's over. But there's no feedback, no growth, no learning, and more than likely, no change. Now, I'll admit that I personally have a lot of bring it on in me. I'm scrappy, I think fast on my feet, and I like my emotions with a little agency. I'm good at anger and only so-so at vulnerability. So armoring up before a vulnerable experience is attractive to me. Luckily, this work has taught me that when I feel self-righteous, it means I'm afraid. It's a way to puff up and protect myself when I'm afraid of being wrong, making someone angry, or getting blamed. Sitting on the same side of the table. In my social work training, a lot of attention was paid to how we talk to people, even down to where and how we sit. For example, I would never talk to a client across a desk. I would walk around my desk and sit in a chair across from that client, so there was nothing big and bulky between us. I remember the first time I went in to see one of my social work professors about a grade. She got up from behind her desk and asked me to take a seat at a small round table she had in her office. She pulled up a chair and sat next to me. In armoring up for that conversation, I had pictured her sitting behind her big metal desk and me defiantly sliding my paper across it and demanding an explanation for my grade. After she sat down next to me, I put the paper on the table. As she said, "I'm so glad you came in to talk to me about your paper. You did a great job on this. I loved your conclusion," and patted me on the back. I awkwardly realized that we were on the same side of the table. Totally discombobulated, I blurted, "Thank you, I worked really hard on it." She nodded and said, "I can tell, thank you. I took some points off for your APA formatting. I'd like for you to focus on that and get it cleaned up. You could submit this for publication, and I don't want the reference formatting to hold you back." I was still confused. She thinks it's publishable? She liked it? She looked at me and said, "Do you need some help with the APA formatting? It's tricky, and it took me years to get it down." This was such a great example of normalizing. I told her that I had fixed the references, and I asked her if she'd take a look at my revisions. She happily agreed and gave me a few tips on the process. I thanked her for her time and left, grateful for my grade and for a teacher who cared as much as she did. Today, sitting on the same side of the table is my metaphor for feedback. I used it to create my engaged feedback checklist. I'm going to read this checklist to you right now, but you can find a printed copy of it on my website at brenebrown.com. The Engaged Feedback Checklist. I know I'm ready to give feedback when I'm ready to sit next to you rather than across from you. I'm willing to put the problem in front of us rather than between us, or sliding it toward you. I'm ready to listen, ask questions, and accept that I may not fully understand the issue. I want to acknowledge what you do well instead of picking apart your mistakes. I recognize your strengths and how you can use them to address your challenges. I can hold you accountable without shaming or blaming you. I'm willing to own my part. I can genuinely thank you for your efforts rather than just criticize you for your failings. I can talk about how resolving these challenges will lead to your growth and opportunity. And last, I can model the vulnerability and openness that I expect to see from you. How would education be different if students, teachers, and parents sat on the same side of the table? How would engagement change if leaders sat down next to folks and said, "Thank you for your contributions. Here's how you're making a difference. This specific issue is getting in the way of your growth, and I think we can tackle it together. What ideas do you have about moving forward? What role do you think I'm playing in the problem? What can I do differently to support you?" Let's go back to the example with Susan, the principal who was armoring up for a smackdown. If she read through this checklist, she'd realize that she's not in a place to give feedback, to be a leader. But with parenting complaints stacking up on her desk, time is an issue for her, and she knows the situation needs to be addressed. It can be very difficult to move into the right head and heart space to give feedback when we're under pressure. So how do we create a safe space for vulnerability and growth when we're not feeling open? Armored feedback doesn't facilitate lasting and meaningful change. I don't know a single person who can be open to accepting feedback or owning responsibility for something when they're being hammered. Our hard wiring takes over, and we self-protect. Susan's best bet is to model the openness that she hopes to see and solicit feedback from one of her colleagues. When I interviewed participants who valued feedback and worked at it, they talked about the necessity of soliciting feedback from their peers, asking for advice, and even role-playing difficult situations. If we're not willing to ask for feedback and receive it, we'll never be good at giving it. If Susan can work through her own feelings so that she can be present with her employee, she's much more likely to see the change she's requesting. Some of you might be wondering, Susan's employee problem is pretty straightforward and small. Why would she need to spend time soliciting feedback from one of her colleagues for a problem like that? It's a good question with an important answer. The size, severity, or complexity of a problem doesn't always reflect our emotional reactivity to it. If Susan can't get to the same side of the table with his teacher, it doesn't matter how simple the problem is or how clear the violation is. What Susan might learn from her peer is that she's really triggered by this particular teacher, or that she's armoring up because unprofessional behavior is becoming a dangerous norm among this cluster of teachers. Giving and soliciting feedback is about learning and growth, and understanding who we are and how we respond to the people around us is the foundation in this process. Again, there's no question that feedback may be one of the most difficult arenas to negotiate in our lives. We should remember, though, that victory is not getting good feedback, avoiding giving difficult feedback, or avoiding the need for feedback. Instead, it's taking off the armor, showing up, and engaging. The courage to be vulnerable. I recently gave a talk at the University of Houston's Wolf Center for Entrepreneurship, the program which pairs 35 to 40 elite undergraduate students with mentors and offers comprehensive business training, is ranked as one of the leading undergraduate entrepreneurship programs in the United States. I was asked to talk to the students about vulnerability and the power of story. During the Q&A session after my talk, one of the students asked me a question that I'm sure is often on the minds of people when I talk about vulnerability. He said, "I can see how vulnerability is important, but I'm in sales and I don't get what that looks like. Does being vulnerable mean that if a customer asks me a question about a product and I don't know the answer, I just say what I'm thinking? Hey, I'm new and I really don't know what I'm doing." The students, who were all turned around listening to him, turned back in their chairs and looked at me as if to say, "Yeah, that seems lame. Are we really supposed to do that?" My answer was no, and yes. In that scenario, vulnerability is recognizing and owning that you don't know something. It's looking the customer in the eye and saying, "I don't know the answer to that, but I'll find out. I want to make sure you have the correct information." I explained that the unwillingness to engage with the vulnerability of not knowing often leads to making excuses, dodging the question, or, worst case scenario, bullshitting. That's the death blow in any relationship. And the one thing I've learned from talking to people who sell for a living is that all sales is about relationship. So while I wouldn't take that tack with a customer, I do think there's some value in sharing the feeling of not knowing what you're doing with someone, whether a mentor who can help offer support and guidance, or a colleague who can help you learn and normalize your experience. Imagine the stress and anxiety of not knowing what you're doing, trying to convince a customer that you do, not being able to ask for help, and not having anyone to talk to about your struggle. This is how we lose people. It's too difficult to stay engaged in these circumstances. We start cutting corners, we stop caring, and we check out. After my talk, one of the mentors came up to me and said, "I've been in sales my entire career, and let me tell you, there's nothing more important than having the courage to say, 'I don't know, and I messed up.' Being honest and open is key to success in every part of our lives." When I was writing this book, I had the opportunity to interview Gay Gaddis, the owner and founder of T3, the think tank in Austin. T3 is a top integrated marketing firm that specializes in innovative marketing campaigns that cut across all media. In 1989, Gay cashed in a $16,000 IRA with the dream of starting an advertising agency. 23 years after opening with a handful of regional accounts, Gay has built T3 into the nation's largest advertising agency wholly owned by a woman, with offices in Austin, New York, and San Francisco. T3 works with clients including Microsoft, UPS, JPMorgan Chase, Pfizer, Allstate, Coca-Cola, and Sprite. Her dynamic business acumen and corporate culture have led to national recognition. She has been named one of Fast Company's top 25 women business builders, Inc. magazine's top 10 entrepreneurs of the year, and one of the top 25 advertising working mothers of the year by Working Mother magazine. Gay and T3's family-friendly workplace program, T3 and Under, was even recognized by the White House. I jumped right into my interview with Gay by telling her that a business journalist had recently told me that unlike leaders in corporations who are shielded by layers of systems, Entrepreneurs can't afford to be vulnerable. When I asked her what she thought about that proposition, she smiled. When you shut down vulnerability, you shut down opportunity. Here's how she explained it. By definition, entrepreneurship is vulnerable. It's all about the ability to handle and manage uncertainty. People are constantly changing, budgets change, boards change, and competition means you have to stay nimble and innovative. You have to create a vision and live up to that vision. There is no vision without vulnerability. Knowing that Gay spends a considerable amount of time teaching and mentoring, I asked her what advice she gives new entrepreneurs about embracing uncertainty. She said success requires entrepreneurs to cultivate strong support networks and good mentors. You need to learn how to shut out the noise so you can get clear on how you feel and what you think. And then you do the hard work. No question, it's all about vulnerability. In businesses, schools, faith communities, any system, even families, we can tell a lot about how people engage with vulnerability by observing how often and how openly you hear people saying the following. I don't know. I need help. I'd like to give it a shot. It's important to me. I disagree. Can we talk about it? It didn't work, but I learned a lot. Yes, I did that. Here's what I need. Here's how I feel. I'd like some feedback. Can I get your take on this? What can I do better next time? Can you teach me how to do this? I played a part in that. I accept responsibility for that. I'm here for you. I want to help. Let's move on. I'm sorry. That means a lot to me. Thank you. For leaders, vulnerability often looks and feels like discomfort. In his book, Tribes, We Need You to Lead Us, Seth Godin writes, leadership is scarce because few people are willing to go through the discomfort required to lead. This scarcity makes leadership valuable. It's uncomfortable to stand up in front of strangers. It's uncomfortable to propose an idea that might fail. It's uncomfortable to challenge the status quo. It's uncomfortable to resist the urge to settle. When you identify the discomfort, you've found the place where a leader is needed. If you're not uncomfortable in your work as a leader, it's almost certain you're not reaching your potential as a leader. As I looked over the data and read through my notes from the interviews I've done with leaders, I wondered what students would say to teachers and what teachers would say to their principals if they had the opportunity to ask for the leadership they needed. I wondered what the customer service representative would say to his boss and what she might ask of her boss. What do we want people to know about us? And what do we need from them? As I started writing down the answers to these questions, I realized they sounded like a mandate, a manifesto. Here's what emerged from these questions. The Daring Greatly Leadership Manifesto. To the CEOs and teachers, to the principals and the managers, to the politicians, community leaders, and decision makers. We want to show up, we want to learn, and we want to inspire. We are hardwired for connection, curiosity, and engagement. We crave purpose, and we have a deep desire to create and contribute. We want to take risks, embrace our vulnerabilities, and be courageous. When learning and working are dehumanized, when you no longer see us and no longer encourage our daring, or when you only see what we produce or how we perform, we disengage and turn away from the very things that the world needs from us, our talent, our ideas, and our passion. What we ask is that you engage with us, show up beside us, and learn from us. Feedback is a function of respect. When you don't have honest conversations with us about our strengths and our opportunities for growth, we question our contributions and your commitment. Above all else, we ask that you show up, let yourself be seen, and be courageous. Dare greatly with us. You can find a printed copy of this manifesto on BrenéBrown.com. Chapter 7, Wholehearted Parenting. Daring to be the adults we want our children to be. Who we are and how we engage with the world are much stronger predictors of how our children will do than what we know about parenting. In terms of teaching our children to dare greatly in the never enough culture, the question isn't so much, are you parenting the right way? As it is, are you the adult that you want your child to grow up to be? Parenting in a culture of never enough. Most of us would love a color-coded parenting handbook that answers all of our unanswerable questions, comes with guarantees, and minimizes our vulnerability. We want to know that if we follow certain rules or adhere to the method espoused by a certain parenting expert, our children will sleep through the night, be happy, make friends, achieve professional success, and stay safe. The uncertainty of parenting can bring up feelings in us that range from frustration to terror. Our need for certainty in an endeavor as uncertain as raising children makes explicit how-to-parent strategies both seductive and dangerous. I say dangerous because certainty often breeds absolutes, intolerance, and judgment. That's why parents are so critical of one another. We latch on to a method or approach, and very quickly, our way becomes the way. When we obsess over our parenting choices to the extent that most of us do, and then see someone else making different choices, we often perceive that difference as direct criticism of how we're parenting. Ironically, parenting is a shame and judgment minefield precisely because most of us are wading through uncertainty and self-doubt when it comes to raising our children. After all, we rarely engage in self-righteous judgment when we feel confident about our decisions. I'm not going to practically knock myself unconscious with a shaming eye roll about your non-organic milk if I feel good about what I'm feeding my children. But if doubt lurks beneath my choices, that self-righteous critic will spring into life in not-so-subtle parenting moments that happen because my underlying fear of not being the perfect parent is driving my need to confirm that, at the very least, I'm better than you. Somewhere, buried deep inside our hopes and fears for our children, is the terrifying truth that there's no such thing as perfect parenting, and there are no guarantees. From debates about attachment parenting and how much better they parent in Europe, to disparagement of helicopter parents, the heated discussions that occupy much of the national parenting conversation conveniently distract us from this important and difficult truth. Who we are and how we engage with the world are much stronger predictors of how our children will do than what we know about parenting. I'm not a parenting expert. In fact, I'm not sure that I even believe in the idea of parenting experts. I'm an engaged, imperfect parent and a passionate researcher. As I mentioned in the introduction, I'm an experienced mapmaker and a stumbling traveler. Like many of you, parenting is by far my boldest and most daring adventure. From the very beginning of my research on shame, I've always collected data on parenting and paid close attention to how research participants talked about being parented and about parenting. The reason is simple. Our stories of worthiness, of being enough, begin in our first families. The narrative certainly doesn't end there, but what we learn about ourselves and how we learn to engage with the world as children sets a course that either will require us to spend a significant part of our life fighting to reclaim our self-worth, or will give us hope, courage, and resilience for our journey. There's no question that our behavior, thinking, and emotions are both hardwired within us and influenced by our environment. I wouldn't hazard a guess on the percentages, but I'm convinced that we'll never have a precise nature-nurture breakdown. I have no doubt, however, that when it comes to our sense of love, belonging, and worthiness, we are most radically shaped by our families of origin, what we hear, what we're told, and perhaps most importantly, how we observe our parents engaging with the world. As parents, we may have less control than we think over temperament and personality, and less control than we want over the scarcity culture. But we do have powerful parenting opportunities in other areas. How we help our children understand, leverage, and appreciate their hardwiring, and how we teach them resilience in the face of relentless, never-enough cultural messages. In terms of teaching our children to dare greatly in the never-enough culture, the question isn't so much, are you parenting the right way, as it is, are you the adult that you want your child to grow up to be? As Joseph Chilton Pierce writes, "What we are teaches the children more than what we say, so we must be what we want our children to become." Even though the vulnerability of parenting is terrifying at times, we can't afford to armor ourselves against it or push it away. It's our richest, most fertile ground for teaching and cultivating connection, meaning, and love. Vulnerability lies at the center of the family story. It defines our moments of greatest joy, fear, sorrow, shame, disappointment, love, belonging, gratitude, creativity, and everyday wonder. Whether we're holding our child, or standing beside them, or chasing them down, or talking through their locked door, vulnerability is what shapes who we are and who our children are. By pushing away vulnerability, we turn parenting into a competition that's about knowing, proving, executing, and measuring, rather than being. If we put aside the question of who's better and put down the yardsticks of school admissions, grades, sports, trophies, and accomplishments, I think the vast majority of us will agree that what we want for our children is what we want for ourselves. We want to raise children who live in love with their whole hearts. If wholeheartedness is the goal, then above all else, we should strive to raise children who engage with the world from a place of worthiness, embrace their vulnerabilities and imperfections, feel a deep sense of love and compassion for themselves and others, value hard work, perseverance, and respect, carry a sense of authenticity and belonging with them, rather than searching for it in external places, have the courage to be imperfect, vulnerable, and creative, don't fear feeling ashamed or unlovable if they're different or if they're struggling. Children who move through our rapidly changing world with courage and a resilient spirit. For parents, this means we're called upon to acknowledge that we can't give our children what we don't have. And so we must let them share in our journey to grow, change, and learn. We have to recognize our own armor and model for our children how to take it off, how to be vulnerable, to show up, to let ourselves be seen and known. We honor our children by continuing on our own journeys toward wholeheartedness. We try to parent from a place of enough rather than scarcity. We try to mind the gap and practice the values we want to teach. And we dare greatly, possibly more than we've ever dared before. In other words, if we want our children to love and accept who they are, our job is to love and accept who we are. We can't use fear, shame, blame, and judgment in our own lives if we want to raise courageous children. Compassion and connection, the very things that give purpose and meaning to our lives, can only be learned if they're experienced. And our families are our first opportunities to experience these things. In this chapter, I want to share what I've learned about worthiness, shame, resilience, and vulnerability, specifically from my parenting research. This work has profoundly transformed the way Steve and I think and feel about parenting. It's dramatically changed our priorities, our marriage, and our day-to-day behaviors. Because Steve is a pediatrician, we spend lots of time discussing parenting research and various parenting models. My goal here is not to teach you how to parent, but to share what might be a new lens through which to view the great dare of raising wholehearted children. Understanding and combating shame. It's a terrible myth to believe that once we have children, our journey ends and theirs begins. For many of us, the most interesting and productive times in our lives come after we have children. For the majority of us, the greatest challenges and struggles also come in midlife and later. Wholehearted parenting is not having it all figured out and passing it down. It's learning and exploring together. And trust me, there are times when my children are way ahead of me on the journey, either waiting for me or reaching back to pull me along. As I mentioned in the introduction, if you roughly divide the people I've interviewed into two groups, those who feel a deep sense of love and belonging and those who struggle for it, only one variable separates the groups. Those who feel lovable, who love, and who experience belonging, simply believe they are worthy of love and belonging. I often say that wholeheartedness is like the North Star. We never really arrive, but we certainly know if we're headed in the right direction. Raising children who believe in their worthiness requires us to model that journey and that struggle. The important thing to know about worthiness is that it doesn't have prerequisites. Most of us, on the other hand, have a long list of worthiness prerequisites, qualifiers that we've inherited, learned, and unknowingly picked up along the way. Most of these prerequisites fall in the categories of accomplishments, acquisitions, and external acceptance. It's the if-when problem. I'll be worthy when, or I'll be worthy if. They may not be written down, and we may not even be aware of the prerequisites, but we all have a list that says, I'll be worthy. What's on that list is different from all of us. Maybe it's, you know, if I get accepted into this school, if my wife's not cheating, when I lose weight, if we don't get divorced, if I get pregnant, if I get promoted, if he asks me out, if we can buy a house in this neighborhood, if no one finds out. Shame loves prerequisites. Our if-when-worthiness list easily doubles as the gremlin's to-do list. On their to-do list are things like, hey, don't let her forget that her mom thinks she should lose that baby weight. Or remind him that his new boss only respects guys with MBAs. Or poke her if she forgets that all of her friends made partner last year. As parents, we help our children develop shame resilience and worthiness by staying very mindful about the prerequisites that we are knowingly or unknowingly handing down to them. Are we sending them overt or covert messages about what makes them more and less lovable? Are we focusing on behaviors that need to change and making it clear that their essential worthiness is not on the table? I often tell parents that some of the most destructive covert messages that we send our children stem from the feminine and masculine norms that we talked about in Chapter 3. Are we overtly or covertly telling our daughters that thin, nice, and modest are prerequisites for worthiness? Are we teaching our girls to respect boys as tender and loving beings? Are we sending messages to our sons that we expect them to be emotionally stoic, to put money and status first, and to be aggressive? Are we teaching our sons to respect women and girls as smart and capable people, not objects? Perfectionism is another source of prerequisites. In a dozen years of studying worthiness, I'm convinced that perfectionism is actually contagious. If we struggle with being, living, and looking absolutely perfect, we might as well line our children up and slip those little perfection straitjackets right over their heads. Just as a reminder from Chapter 4, perfectionism is not teaching them how to strive for excellence or to be their best selves. Perfectionism is teaching them to value what other people think over what they think or how they feel. It's teaching them to perform, please, and prove. Unfortunately, I have many examples from my own life. For instance, when Ellen got her first tardy at school, she immediately broke down crying. She was so upset about breaking the rules and upsetting her teacher or the principal that she just fell apart. We kept telling her that it wasn't a big deal and that everyone is late sometimes until she felt better. That evening, we celebrated surviving our first tardy with a little tardy party after dinner. She finally agreed that it wasn't a big deal and that other people probably didn't judge her for being human. Fast forward 4 days to Sunday morning. We're running late for church and I'm in tears. Why can't we ever get out of here on time? We're gonna be late. Ellen looked up at me and earnestly asked, Dad and Charlie will be here in 1 minute. Are we missing something important? Without hesitating, I said, No, I just hate walking in late and sneaking down the aisle. It's the 9 o'clock service, not the 9:05 service. She looked confused for a second, then grinned as she said, It's not a big deal. Everyone's late sometimes, remember? I'll throw a tardy party for you when we get home. Sometimes prerequisites and perfectionism are handed down in very subtle ways. One of the very best pieces of parenting advice that I ever received was from the writer Toni Morrison. It was May of 2000, and Ellen was just shy of her first birthday. Ms. Morrison was on Oprah talking about her book, The Bluest Eye. Oprah said, Toni says a beautiful thing about the messages that we get about who we are when a child first walks into a room, and she asked Ms. Morrison to talk about it. Ms. Morrison explained that it's interesting to watch what happens when a child walks into a room. She asked, Does your face light up? She explained, When my children used to walk in the room when they were little, I looked at them to see if they had buckled their trousers or if their hair was combed or if their socks were up. You think your affection and your deep love is on display because you're caring for them. It's not. When they see you, they see the critical face. What's wrong now? Her advice was simple, but paradigm shifting for me. She said, Let your face speak what's in your heart. When they walk in the room, my face says, I'm glad to see them. It's just as small as that, you see. I literally think about that advice every day. It's become a practice. When Ellen comes bounding down the stairs dressed for school, I don't want my first comment to be, pull your hair back, or those shoes don't match your dress. I want my face to convey how happy I am to see her, to be with her. When Charlie comes to the back door and he's sweaty and dirty from catching lizards, I want to flash a smile before I say, don't touch anything until you wash your hands. So often we think that we can earn parenting points by being critical, put out, and exasperated. Those first looks can be prerequisites or worthiness builders. I don't want to criticize when my kids walk in a room. I want to light up. In addition to keeping a mindful eye on prerequisites and perfectionism, we can help our children keep and cultivate their sense of worthiness in another way, one that relates back to what we learned about the differences between shame and guilt. Research indicates that parenting is a primary predictor of how prone our children will be to shame or guilt. In other words, we have a lot of influence over how our kids think about themselves and their struggles. Knowing, as we do, that shame is positively correlated with addiction, depression, aggression, violence, eating disorders, and suicide, and that guilt is inversely correlated with those outcomes, we naturally would want to raise children who use more guilt self-talk than shame. This means we need to separate our children from their behaviors. As it turns out, there's a significant difference between "you are bad" and "you did something bad." And no, it's not just semantics. Shame corrodes the part of us that believes we can do better and be better. When we shame and label our children, we take away their opportunity to grow and try on new behaviors. If a child tells a lie, she can change that behavior. If she's a liar, where's the potential for change in that? Cultivating more guilt self-talk and less shame self-talk requires rethinking how we discipline and talk to our children. But it also means explaining these concepts to our kids. Children are very receptive to talking about shame if we're willing to do it. By the time they're 4 and 5, we can explain to them the difference between shame and guilt and how much we love them even when they make bad choices. When Ellen was in kindergarten, her teacher called me at home one afternoon and said, "I totally get what you do now." When I asked her why, she said earlier in the week, she had looked over at Ellen, who was in the glitter center, and said, "Ellen, you're a mess." Apparently, Ellen got a very serious look on her face and said, "I may be making a mess, but I'm not a mess." I'm pretty sure that's the day I became that parent. Charlie also gets a distinction between shame and guilt. When I found our dog pulling food out of the trash can, I scolded her by saying, "Bad girl." Charlie came sliding around the corner shouting, "Daisy is a good girl who made a bad choice. We love her. We just don't love her choices." When I tried to explain the difference by saying, "Charlie, Daisy's a dog," his response was, "Oh, I see. Daisy is a good dog who made a bad choice." Shame is so painful for children because it's inextricably linked to the fear of being unlovable. For young children who are still dependent on their parents for survival, for food, shelter, and safety, feeling unlovable is a threat to survival. It's trauma. I'm convinced that the reason most of us revert back to feeling childlike and small when we're in shame is because our brain stores our early shame experiences as trauma. And when it's triggered, we return to that place. We don't have the neurobiological research yet to confirm this, but I've coded hundreds of interviews that follow this same pattern. The participant will say, "I don't know what happened. My boss called me an idiot in front of my team and I couldn't respond. All of a sudden, I'm back in Mrs. Porter's second grade class. I'm speechless. I can't come back with one decent response." Or, "My son struck out for the second time and I couldn't see straight. I always said I'd never do to him what my dad did to me, but there I was screaming at him in front of his teammates. I'm not even sure how it happened." In Chapter 3, we learn that the brain processes social rejection or shame, the exact way it processes physical pain. I suspect we'll eventually have the data to support my hypothesis about children storing shame as trauma. But in the meantime, I can say without hesitation that childhood experiences of shame change who we are, how we think about ourselves, and our sense of self-worth. We can work hard to not use shame as a parenting tool, but our children are still going to encounter shame in the outside world. The good news is that when children understand the distinction between shame and guilt, and when they know that we're interested and open to talking about these feelings and experiences, they are much more likely to talk to us about the shaming experiences they may encounter with teachers, coaches, clergy, babysitters, grandparents, and other adults who have influence in their lives. This is critically important because it gives us the opportunity to crop shame the way we do photographs. I often use a scrapbook as a metaphor to talk about the impact shame has on children. As parents, once we learn about shame, we will more than likely realize that, yes, we've shamed our children. It happens, even to shame researchers. Given the severity of the outcomes around shame, we'll also begin to worry that the shaming moments that happen outside of our home will define our children, despite our best efforts in the family. And those experiences will happen. Name-calling, put-downs, and teasing are rampant in our culture of cruelty. The good news, however, is that we have a lot of influence over how much power those experiences have in our children's lives. Most of us can remember shaming events from childhood that felt defining. But more than likely, we remember them because we didn't process those experiences with parents who were open to talking about shame and committed to helping us cultivate shame resilience. I don't blame my parents for that any more than I judge my grandmother letting me stand next to her in the front seat while she was driving. They didn't have access to the information we have today. Knowing what I do now, I think about shame and worthiness in this way. It's the album, not the picture. If you imagine opening up a photo album, and many of the pages are full of 8x10 photos of shaming events, you'll close that album and walk away thinking, shame defines that story. If, on the other hand, you open that album and see a few small photos of shame experiences, but each one is surrounded by pictures of worthiness, hope, struggle, resilience, courage, failure, success, and vulnerability, the shame experiences are only a part of a larger story. They don't define the album. Again, we can't shame-proof our children. Our task instead is teaching and modeling shame resilience. And that starts with conversations about what shame is and how it shows up in our lives. The adults I interviewed, who were raised by parents who used shame as a primary parenting tool, had much more difficulty believing in their worthiness than the participants who experienced shame occasionally and were able to talk about it with their parents. If you have grown children and are wondering if it's too late to teach shame resilience or to change the album, the answer is no, it's not too late. The power of owning our stories, even the difficult ones, is that we get to write the ending. Several years ago, I received a letter from a woman who wrote, "Your work changed my life in a very strange way. My mom saw you speak at a church in Amarillo. Afterwards, she wrote me a long letter that said, 'I had no idea there was a difference between shame and guilt. I think I shamed you your entire life. I meant to use guilt. I never thought you weren't good enough. I did not like your choices, but I shamed you, and I can't take that back, but I need you to know that you're the best thing that ever happened to me, and I'm so proud to be your mother.'" The woman said, "I couldn't believe it. My mom is 75, and I'm 55. It healed so much, and it changed everything, including the way I parent my own kids." In addition to helping our children understand shame and use guilt self-talk rather than shame self-talk, we have to be very careful about shame leakage. Even if we don't shame our children, shame still shows up in our lives in ways that can have a powerful effect on our family. Basically, we can't raise children who are more shame resilient than we are. I can encourage Ellen to love her body, but what really matters are the observations she makes about my relationship with my own body. Damn it. I can soothe Charlie's concerns that he might run the wrong direction around the bases by telling him that he doesn't have to fully understand the ins and outs of baseball before his first t-ball game. But does he observe me and Steve trying new things, making mistakes, and failing without becoming self-critical? Damn it again. Lastly, normalizing is one of the most powerful shame resilience tools we can offer our children. Like I explained in the last chapter, normalizing means helping our children know that they're not alone and that we've experienced many of the same struggles. This applies to social situations, changes in their bodies, shaming experiences, feeling left out, and wanting to be brave but feeling afraid. There's something sacred that happens between a parent and a child when the parent says "me too" or shares a personal story that relates to their child's struggle. Minding the gap, supporting our children means supporting each other. I believe it's important at this point to pause to recognize the shaming nature of parenting values debates. When you listen to conversations or read books and blogs about controversial and/or divisive issues in parenting, like how and where women labor, circumcision, vaccinations, co-sleeping, feeding, etc., what you hear is shame, and what you see is hurt. deep hurt. You see people, mostly mothers, engaging in the exact same behaviors that I earlier defined as shaming. Name-calling, put-downs, bullying. Here's what I've come to believe about those behaviors.